Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the CJPME Debrief Podcast, a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East and a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Together, we discuss developments and issues in Canada's relationship with Palestine and the broader Middle East. Through our conversations, we make sense of events in the region and how people in Canada can respond. It has been nearly 3 months since Amnesty International published their landmark report on Israel's apartheid against the Palestinians. In this episode, we are joined by Sela Hejazi, who leads Amnesty's office in Jerusalem. We'll talk about why Amnesty came to the conclusion of apartheid. My name is Michael Buechert, Vice President of CJPME and the podcast host for today. With me is Tom Woodley, CJPME President and our podcast co-host. Good afternoon, Tom.
Hello, Michael. How are you doing?
Good. And we are very honored to be joined today by Sela Hejazi, Amnesty International's Deputy Regional Director for the Middle East and North Africa and head of Amnesty's office in Jerusalem. He's also an advisor to the Al-Quds University Human Rights Clinic, where he worked as an academic coordinator and lecturer. And he is a Palestinian citizen of Israel presently living in Ramallah. Welcome to the podcast, Sela.
Thanks, Michael. Hi, Tom.
How are you?
So before we start getting into things, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you ended up at Amnesty?
I'm a Palestinian citizen of Israel, as it came in your introduction. I was born and raised in Jerusalem, between Jerusalem and Ramallah. I started my human rights career following a degree from the Human Rights Center at Essex University in the UK, in the theory and practice of human rights. Following that, I joined the Human Rights Clinic at Al-Quds University. It was a newly established center that basically provides legal services through an academic program for students to Palestinians around, particularly on human rights issues that relate to forcible displacement, restrictions of movement, and family separation and other. I also worked briefly with Human Rights Watch. Before then, in 2011, going to move to London to join Amnesty, where I was a researcher on Israel and Palestine, and then returned here to head the office in 2018.
You know, we've been watching things get worse on the ground. From Canada, we've been watching media reports. Things don't seem to be getting any better. I guess from your position more closer to the ground, what do you make of the current, what some would call an escalation? The media usually calls tensions. What do you make of this, and what does this have to do with apartheid?
So the media picks it up and calls it an escalation or tension only when the system of apartheid, Israel's apartheid against Palestinians, is showing more of a spectacular violent side, right? So what we've been seeing since the beginning of the year is an uptick of patterns of unlawful killings, arbitrary detention, torture, and ill-treatment, including against children, and collective punishment against what we've seen in Jenin, for example, following condemned attacks against Israeli civilians in different cities in Israel, but also on Jerusalem, particularly in the month of Ramadan, where there was restrictions on access to movement, to the religious site, and whatnot. These patterns are not new, and they're not a response to some new development. They are part of the underlying structure, which the Amnesty report describes in documenting and analyzing Israel's apartheid against Palestinians. These acts, these patterns, unlawful killings, arbitrary detention and torture, and the denying of basic rights, are perpetrated to maintain a system of oppression and domination that Israel has put in place against Palestinian citizens, its establishment. This system fragments Palestinians into different geographic areas. It then segregates them, both in law and in physical presence within these separated areas, violently controls them, including by the use of military occupation, like has been the case in the West Bank and Gaza since 1967, and before, against Palestinian citizens of Israel, from the establishment of the state in 1948 until 1966. There was a military rule over Palestinian citizens of Israel. And dispossession of land and property is the taking away of land and basically allowing that control to Jewish Israelis, and the privation of basic rights, economic and social rights. This is what makes up the system of oppression and domination. At the heart of it is the intent to maintain Jewish Israeli hegemony, both in terms of demography and geography, meaning Jewish Israelis to be the majority of the population and to control maximum amount of land within the area that Israel controls. This is the intent behind the system, that is fragmentation, segregation, deprivation, dispossession. And then you have unlawful acts, basically grave human rights violations like we've been seeing since the beginning of the year. 41 Palestinians have been killed since the beginning of the year outside the context of armed conflict. This is very important to stress. There was no armed conflict. These are what may be called law enforcement activities by the Israeli army and other forces against Palestinians. 41 Palestinians were killed, including 8 children. Some of those killed appear to have been killed in circumstances of extrajudicial executions. There was an incident in Nablus earlier this year where Israeli special forces stopped the car with 3 men in it, got down, shot them inside of the car, and left the scene. This incident is very well documented by B'Tselem and other human rights organizations. These patterns are perpetrated to maintain the system, and this is what's happening. We only call it an escalation or tension, and we find cause to restore calm when Israelis are killed. Now, again, this is Israel, the killing of civilians anywhere is condemned, but there is structural violence that happens every day. It's been happening for decades, and this has to be dealt with. The media, states, and others cannot only pay attention when you have incidents like this. They have to address the root causes of this. This is what the UN, for example, last year, following the escalation, very similar to what's happening right now, did with the establishment of the Commission of Inquiry by the Human Rights Council, is say that we're establishing this commission to look into human rights violations in Israel and the OPT to address root causes. So there is consensus now by civil society organizations, human rights organizations, but also by the UN, that we need to address root causes. And apartheid is a legal framework that allows us to do so. This is what we've done in our report. And this is what we hope will help address the escalation we've been seeing since the beginning of the year.
Yeah. You know, you make such a good point that, you know, the mainstream media tends to ignore the just ongoing incidents everywhere throughout Palestine. I used to go to the website of the Negotiations Affairs Departments of the PLO, where they every single day they would list, you know, in Nablus, this is what happened. In Hebron, this is what happened. And it was break-ins and seizures and arrests and killings and all that sort of stuff. Every single day you could go in. So sometimes when I was meeting a member of parliament, I just go in and say, okay, well, earlier today, this is what happened in Palestine. You know, and it's very important that people understand that. You know, it's great. I really like the way that you framed that, because it is very much, that is the status quo. That is the day-to-day reality for Palestinians.
Mm-hmm. And much of this, I think, is the things that you're documenting. These elements of structural violence are not, you know, obviously they're not new. These are things that you've been documenting for years and years. There does seem to be a bit of a paradigm shift in the way that Amnesty is talking about this now, with the report that was released almost 3 months ago now, concluding that this amounts to apartheid. We've talked about this on our podcast a bit about the details of that. And, you know, when it came out, we saw it as sort of a change in how Amnesty was approaching this. But I guess maybe if you could tell us a little bit about why now, like, where did this come from to sort of come to this conclusion of apartheid? Why was it important to conduct that analysis now?
So the story is actually quite long. It starts a couple of decades ago, when Palestinian organizations, human rights defenders, academics, intellectuals began using the legal framework of apartheid to understand and reflect and report on the situation on the ground. What they've been saying, or what they said then, is that this is the proper framework that allows for a proper understanding and then action accordingly. Apartheid is a crime against humanity. And there's not only a moral responsibility, but also a legal responsibility on states to take action to end the situation of extreme violent discrimination by one group over another. Amnesty was, of course, listening to Palestinian organizations. There were conversations. There were also, Amnesty is a movement of sections all around the world, and there were some sections who were also asking the organization to look into the question of apartheid. But where things were put into motion more, I want to say, effectively was, and this is a story I like to tell when describing kind of the background to this report. In 2013, I was a researcher based in London with Amnesty looking into the situation in Israel and Palestine. And there was an uptick of unlawful killings, very similar to what's happening right now in the occupied West Bank. So I went with colleagues. We investigated and documented this pattern, or uptick of pattern of unlawful killings. And of course, within it, there was case studies from across the West Bank, including from the village of Nabi Saleh. The village of Nabi Saleh is just outside of Ramallah. It's a very small village. Where its lands have been taken away to give to illegal Israeli settlements nearby. And in 2019, they started weekly protests against the occupation, against oppression, against the settlements, but also to try to reclaim a water spring that was taken away by settlers. And of course, with the support from the army. These protests were met with brutal force. There was excessive use of force. There was collective punishment. And in the context of these protests, two Palestinian residents of Nabi Saleh were killed, Rushdi Tamimi and Mustafa Tamimi. And so we covered both the use of excessive force, but also the unlawful killings, and wrote a report that was published in February 2014. Following the publication, we took a report back to the West Bank to visit the communities and discuss it with them. So we went to Nabi Saleh, and there was a very warm welcome for the Amnesty delegation. We sat together in this circle with other activists They said, thank you very much for documenting violations, for reporting on them, letting the world know what happens. And then one of the prominent activists in the village, Bassam Tamimi, himself a victim of torture from the 90s after he was arrested when his sister was killed by an Israeli prison guard and was declared a prisoner of conscience by Amnesty International when he was imprisoned for basically practicing his right to freedom of assembly and expression. He opens the recommendation page of the report and says, again, thank you, great work. But what I see here is that Amnesty is telling the occupation how to kill and oppress better. Basically, what he went on to explain to say that it was constructive criticism, I mean, although it came out very, very sharply. He was explaining that Amnesty and other organizations are dealing with the symptoms of something that is structural. And we're not really tackling that structure of oppression, of domination, of inequality, of dispossession. And that without doing so, we may be actually helping with reproducing this oppression and this reality of injustice. And so he was asking us to really consider that. And we took that very seriously, of course, went back to start conversations. Unfortunately, that year, Israel launches a military offensive on Gaza in July of 2014 that lasts 52 days, massive death and destruction. But what happened after the war was actually a creation of an opportunity because Palestine was recognized by the UN as a non-member observer state in 2012, was now able to join international conventions and treaties and joined the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. Which means that now the ICC, the International Criminal Court, has jurisdiction over the occupied Palestinian territories. And as a human rights organization, we started looking into the Rome Statute and what crimes prescribed there, crimes against humanity and war crimes, actually may be applied to the human rights crisis in Israel and Palestine. And of course, apartheid sticks out immediately. Anyone who's been here, who's documented, who knows the situation, sees the vast and radical difference between Jewish Israelis on one hand and Palestinians on another. Wherever Israel has control. In the West Bank, it's very visible because you see the illegal settlements, Israelis being treated under Israeli civil law, while Palestinians are living in these enclaves, deprived of basic rights, and treated according to military orders. Right? So we started examining the crime of apartheid and then reached a conclusion that we needed a policy that allows the organization, Amnesty, to define apartheid and will provide also guidelines for researchers and practitioners to test and examine situations of institutionalized discrimination and whether they amount to the crime against humanity or apartheid. That policy was developed over a couple of years. In 2017, it was enacted and it was voted on by sections, Amnesty sections all around the world. The policy provides a definition according to international law. It grabs from the Rome Statute, the definition of apartheid from the Rome Statute and from the Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid, and then provides a six-part legal test that you would apply to situations you suspect may amount to apartheid. And see whether you're able to reach that determination, which you would further test with the report. And this is what we've done then. We applied the policy, the guidelines, and in 2019 reached an internal determination that there is evidence that Israel is perpetrating the crime against humanity of apartheid against Palestinians. And we went and further tested that with the report that you now have between your hands. So the report, the basis of it is this policy and the guidelines. And then what it does is it analyzes the body of laws, policies, and practices that Israel puts in place to control the rights of Palestinians, as well as documentation that we've done over 20 years. So we looked back at what Amnesty has been doing in documenting not only unlawful killings, but also forcible displacement and many other patterns of human rights violations. Also carried out fresh documentation within the context of writing this report, eventually basically then producing this, concluding that Israel is imposing a cruel system of oppression and domination amounting to apartheid, and also a crime against humanity of apartheid against Palestinians, meaning that it is against the people, where Palestinians, citizens of Israel, those inside what is called the Green Line, those in the occupied territories, West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, but also Palestinian refugees who have been forcibly displaced by Israel in 1948 and 1967, and not been allowed their right to return.
Mm-hmm. It's clear that Amnesty didn't make this decision lightly or rushed to it, but it, as you're talking about the process, it took years of listening to people on the ground, of engaging in serious legal analysis at different stages, getting internally, getting people on board behind a definition that sounds very slow, but very deliberate. And I think that's why I think it's so such a powerful document, is because of that work that went into it. It strikes me that it came out a year after reports, as you know, from Human Rights Watch, B'Tselem, Yesh Din, all within the last couple of years, as well. Al-Haq put in a submission to the UN in 2019. And just recently, as we spoke to on the podcast, Michael Link, the UN Special Rapporteur, just issued a report concluding that apartheid is being practiced in the occupied territories at a minimum. What do you make of that, of this timing? What is it about the current moment that obviously you didn't simply jump on this following these other groups, but this was in the process for years and years? How are all of these different groups coming to this conclusion independently now? What do you make of that?
A response to what Palestinians, and this is amazing, right? Because it's a response to what Palestinians have been doing and asking for. Last year, for example, was very significant. Following the publication of the B'Tselem report earlier in 2021, and then the Human Rights Watch report in April of 2021, you had the events of May and June. Mm-hmm. There was something that was very significant that happened then, was that Palestinians across of Mandate Palestine, meaning Israel and occupied Palestinian territories, have held a strike. They didn't go to work, they didn't go to schools, they didn't open shops. All Palestinians from Haifa inside of Israel to Jenin and Ramallah in the occupied West Bank, all the way to Jerusalem that is illegally annexed, and down to the Naqab, the desert south of Israel, Palestinians acted as one group, basically stressing that they are one people despite the fragmentation, and actually taking action against this fragmentation by this, you know, united action of a strike. This is unprecedented. It didn't happen before. Perhaps, and I'm not a historian, perhaps there was a strike of a similar nature in the 1930s. When Palestinians also revolted against what was at the time the British colonial rule in Palestine. But it did not happen perhaps since then until 2021. So it was very significant kind of like a message that was coming out from the Palestinian people without a leadership, mind you. It was not that you had spokespeople, you didn't have the Palestinian Authority really speak for the strike or anybody inside of Israel. It was really the people speaking through their action. And so, these reports come in response, and this is not just kind of, it cannot be seen only in 2021. There has been a buildup towards this over many, many years, over decades, right? Mm-hmm. In 2011, there was a march by Palestinian refugees in Syria and Lebanon asking for their right to return decades after they were displaced. You know, they marched onto the borders and they were massacred. They were killed by Israeli forces. In 2018, Gazans who are locked into the criminal blockade since 2007 have marched onto what is called the fence that separates Israel from Gaza, asking for their right to return to their homes and for the siege to be lifted. So Palestinians have been accumulating this, you know, one resistance and messaging to the world that please understand our situation as that of structural domination and oppression, and deal with it as such. And so, in a way, these reports are a response, I feel to that. It's also because other legal frameworks, you know, primarily the international humanitarian law, the law of occupation, has been ineffective when dealing with the situation on the ground. The occupation itself, and you know, just recently, Professor Michael Ling, Special Rapporteur on the human rights situation in the OPT, has started questioning the legality of the occupation. And that was just only a few years ago. But before, the law allows for a military occupation, it's just the practices of it. And despite a lot of documentation, reporting, massive, you know, there's a massive, I want to say, regime of human rights around Israel and Palestine. Commissions of inquiries, investigative committees by the UN and other organizations. You have Amnesty and Human Rights Watch working on the situation, professional, really well-established Palestinian and Israeli organizations that are documenting. And despite all of this, the situation was only getting worse. So obviously, you needed something different. You needed a framework that has teeth, that allows you to tackle the situation for what it is and really provide remedies for it. So what I want to say, just to end on this point, I mean, despite, you know, the long time, with Amnesty's report, we have now a consensus among civil society organizations working on the human rights situation in Israel and Palestine that Israel is perpetrating the crime against humanity of apartheid against Palestinians. This consensus is by Palestinian, Israeli, and international organizations. And it has grown, as you pointed, to now the UN, which is extremely welcome and very important to have the Special Rapporteur also reach the same finding as other organizations about apartheid. And we hope that this consensus now grows. We want it to grow within the UN. We have a very important opportunity with the Commission of Inquiry set up by the Human Rights Council last year. But most importantly, grow amongst states, for states to recognize the situation for what it is and really take action to dismantle Israel's apartheid against Palestinians.
Yeah. And, you know, to your point, we spoke to Michael Link a few weeks ago, and you know, he pointed out, like, occupations are not meant to be permanent, but there's every indication that sort of Israel has put in place a permanent occupation. And so Michael was telling us, like, you know, as you're saying, the law that applies to occupations, what didn't seem sufficient anymore. And that, you know, so, and when does an occupation, I think in his report, he says something like, when does an occupation become something much more sinister and nefarious? And it's interesting hearing the exact same perspective from yourself. And now, yeah, the law, looking at it from the law of occupation, just wasn't sufficient anymore. So really insightful perspective. Thank you.
I want to talk a little bit about some of the responses that you've had over the last 2.5 months or so that this report has been out. When it was first issued, we did have a chance to speak to a longtime Amnesty volunteer here in Montreal, who spoke to us about how, in their opinion, this report really liberated them on the ground to be able to speak truthfully about the situation and to work closer with solidarity groups like us and others who they might have felt more restrictive in their partnerships before, because we use the analysis of apartheid and call for, you know, economic pressure on Israel as a response. I guess I'm wondering if you have similar thoughts about the impact of this analysis. Do you find that it removes constraints from the work that you do now that you have this analysis to work with?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Of course, and I go back, you know, I think the story that I was telling about in Basaleh is very relevant here, because perhaps in some points it's restrictions, you know, and there are restrictions even with applying legal frameworks when it comes to human rights organizations, because they deal within just that framework, mm-hmm. within law, and are limited when it comes to politics. That's fine. But I think what was problematic is that you're seeing the situation for what it is. You're seeing that it is structural, it is prolonged, and it has this intention, a criminal intention, right, behind it, but you're not able to address it as such. And you keep being basically pushed to dealing with the symptoms of it, right? Describing things in the abstract that, you know, we have an uptick in unlawful killings, we'll just deal with it as such. And we document, we report, we build advocacy and campaigning plans around it. And then you have another development. You have Palestinians held in administrative detention, which is detention without charge or trial, hold, for example, hunger strikes and being mistreated by the Israeli authorities. So you switch completely and go to that. And then all of a sudden you have a military offensive on Gaza, and tens of children are dying. And then, so you switch to that. And all the time, you're not able to act strategically and really work within a theory of change that would bring human rights impact. And the reason is because, you know, you're dealing with all these, of course, a very important document on all of us. You're not seeing how they're connected altogether in this system of oppression and domination. And without really addressing that, you're not able to really create an impact. And perhaps, you know, as the activist Nabi Saleh was saying, is that you're producing the oppression and injustice in some way, unintentionally, of course. And so I think that is what's liberating, is that now you feel there is a framework, a language, a discourse that really speaks for what the reality is, and that this framework also has legal mechanisms within it that would, perhaps it'll take a long time, but there are legal remedies to apartheid that are there, which we're making use of, that hopefully and eventually may bring a change, right? So, so absolutely, I think a lot of people would share the sentiment and feeling of the Amnesty Canada volunteer across. And we've seen amazing response within the Amnesty movement. And I could speak about kind of the response outside of it as well. But within Amnesty, brilliant. A lot of sections were, as I was saying, part of why we did that work was because we had sections demand that Amnesty examine the question of apartheid. So already the movement came from them, or they were part of this initial part of the process. And now that it's out, it's that you have this energy and kind of strategy unleashed. You know, amazing things are happening in Canada, in Ireland, in South Africa, in Senegal, in Indonesia. And it's really brilliant to see how then the Amnesty movement is kind of put in motion now in a framework of an anti-apartheid movement.
Yeah. You know, if we tie that back to something you were saying earlier in the conversation about, you know, that, you know, clashes or escalations are just sort of a way of saying that, well, Israelis are getting hurt or Israelis are getting killed or affected in some way, and that the actual status quo, you know, is still violent, still very violent on an ongoing, but in a more subtle way. And so by obviously putting the apartheid lens on it, as you've explained, it sort of describes, well, this other stuff that's going on is of course violent. The question is, I guess, how do we, do you have any thoughts or advice in terms of how we can get politicians, international politicians, to start seeing that way? Well, I guess the first step is to call it apartheid and put out reports. But have you had any success in terms of helping politicians to sort of see it that way, that it's there's the violence is between the clashes and between the escalations, which is really what needs our attention? Any advice or insight on that?
It is, you know, I want to say, and especially when it comes to Western governments, governments of Europe, the UK, North America, it's particularly, the conversations are particularly difficult. You know, and very unfortunately, there is a block even before you start talking.
Right.
And not always, and not, you know, this is not a blanket. You do have some very positive, I want to say, pockets within. There is, though, at the level of government, that this negative reaction. But then if you look a bit outside of that, civil society and parliamentarians, and I want to stress particularly parliamentarians, I think this is where the important strategic work should be done, right? It's, yes, we are going to pressure governments to hopefully recognize and engage with the situation as it is.
Right.
But for a more kind of structural, strategic decision, we want parliamentarians to recognize, for parliamentarians to pass resolutions recognizing Israel's apartheid, to pass action that states need to take, and really question their governments, particularly at this time where double standards and hypocrisy when it comes to international law. I'm speaking here in relation to the Russian aggression on Ukraine.
Right.
We've seen brilliantly very, you know, happy to see how the international order of international law, of sanctions, of the other measures that were quickly kind of whipped together and put against a state that is violating international law. We want to see the same across the board, including for Israel, right? So I think parliamentarians listen more so than people in the government, and we should keep basically after them, not only those who already have an opening ear to kind of educate them more and really provide them with the tools and the support to do so, but also those who are perhaps not on this side of the fence, one may be able to jump because they care about human rights and international law, and not only when it comes to Palestinians, but all around, right? And this is what we say, an undermining of the international order when it comes to Israel has implications to everywhere else around the world. Mm-hmm. If you allow for, you know, black holes of impunity, like in the case of Israel, if you allow for the state to be treated at a much lower standard than others, then this is an undermining of the entire system.
Absolutely.
And I think then countries that particularly, you know, here, Canada, and I will mention particularly in relation to the International Criminal Court, is that, you know, it's very important for then politicians, parliamentarians to see the implications, you know, not in regards to Palestinians, but the implications worldwide, the strategic implications for them then undermining a process of accountability like this. And I hope this report then helps for these conversations to continue. It's going to be a long way until we dismantle Israel's apartheid. But it really starts with people's power. It's people being educated, mobilizing, reaching out to the parliamentarians, and starting really from the bottom up until we reach the change we want to see.
Absolutely, yeah.
That dynamic that you describe of Western governments is definitely what we've seen here. The Canadian government pretty much just flatly rejected the report completely. My understanding is that they have not even responded to the letter from Amnesty International Canada regarding the report, has not met with them. But we have seen a number of parliamentarians who have been interested in this. I would say that they're definitely more open to discussing the issue of apartheid now that Amnesty has this report. That's not something that most people can flippantly put aside. And we saw, you know, the New Democratic Party in particular pushing in Parliament, asking the Foreign Affairs Minister to explain why it has rejected the Amnesty report. And the response was there was no response. It was an inability to name a reason for it. And that was really effective at exposing the sort of the bankruptcy of the government's position on this. So we are seeing some interesting processes here. I think there's definitely cracks in the sort of edifice that we can push at. I'm curious, too, around the world. I know that you've been traveling a lot and meeting a lot of people to talk about this report. You went to South Africa, even, which has its history of apartheid. I mean, that the crime of apartheid is named after the system that was imposed in South Africa. I'm curious whether there's anything interesting that has come up in those conversations outside of Canada, outside maybe even of the West.
Yeah, when it comes to what may be called kind of the global South, and I've been to South Africa, Senegal, I've been doing events. For example, yesterday I joined an event organized by the Indonesian Ministry of Foreign Affairs in commemoration of the Bandung Conference that was held in Indonesia decades ago. You see a completely different reaction than that from the West. There is an understanding, there is an affinity, and not only among the level of the people, but also the level of officials. In South Africa, for example, I had a meeting with the Minister of Foreign Affairs. She had, before our meeting, a speech in Parliament the day before, recognizing Israel's apartheid against Palestinians and condemning it and saying that South Africa has a responsibility to take action against that. And that was reiterated then in our meeting. There was a clear kind of show of then leadership when it comes from South Africa on this issue. Like, for example, one of our recommendations that came in our report and in other reports by Palestinians and Israeli and other organizations is to establish a mechanism at the General Assembly, UN General Assembly level, a re-establishment of what was called the Committee Against Apartheid that was established in 1962 to respond to the system in South Africa, to re-establish that with a global mandate to look at apartheid anywhere it may exist, including Israel's apartheid against Palestinians. And South Africa is showing leadership, basically, to, for example, drafting the resolution and come September, basically mobilizing others to vote for it. So this is the kind of action that, you know, we very much like to see and is very encouraging, that is supported by Namibia. We've heard, for example, yesterday in the conference in Indonesia, a very important kind of an understanding. There's a basis of discussion that is found among countries of the global south that have experienced colonialism, that have experienced discrimination and racism, that you start the conversation from. And so it's very much kind of forward-looking. It's how we could do things together, how we have a responsibility to act on principle, because of our shared history, because of this, which does not, you know, exist in what may be called kind of the global north. Mm-hmm. So this is very encouraging, right? Really seeing kind of the global reaction to it also, that the center of gravity here is not, yes, the center of power is the global north, but then when it comes to change, we're looking at it much broader. And people are reacting to these reports and kind of the, I would say, this historic perhaps turning point from different angles of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Namibia's support for the special committee is the UN Special Committee Against Apartheid is really important too, because Namibia was occupied by apartheid South Africa for decades and imposed apartheid policies on Namibia. So the two countries that actually experienced Namibia, and the reason for that committee to have existed in the first place was to investigate practices there. Now they're both interested in supporting bringing that back to look at apartheid elsewhere. So I think that's really, I wish more people knew about that. I think it lends a lot of credibility and authority to it, which is really interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just have to point out for Saleh, Michael actually he did his PhD thesis looking partly at South African apartheid and the resistance to the BDS movement, the boycott of South Africa, and comparing that to the boycott of Israel. So that's why Michael is just so on top of things. So yeah, Michael, we've got to work on that, don't we? Great, make sure people are more aware of how significant that is. So good point. Sorry to interrupt you there.
Of course. But then on the flip side, completely is the Israeli government's response, which, I mean, anytime you criticize a government's human rights abuses, it's going to, you know, not accept it, I think, in most cases. Although the Israeli government has been very aggressive about it, calling it anti-Semitic even before it was released. And I've seen reports of supporters of Israel in different countries calling for countries to punish Amnesty by revoking its charitable status and taking other measures in response. I mean, you must have expected some backlash to this. How has Amnesty been able to deal with this, with that element of the response?
Well, look, it's an overused tactic, right? Unfortunately, you don't have the Israeli authorities engaging on the substance of the report. We haven't had that engagement at all with them. Even before the report, very important to point out that it seems there was an unwritten policy of not engaging with Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, or other organizations, despite, for example, us writing letters, sharing findings, asking for commentary from different Israeli authorities. We don't get any engagement. They don't want to talk about substance, and they always go towards, and this is very typical, I want to say, of oppressive, repressive states, that you shoot the messenger and you use all these false, ridiculous accusations to try to divert then the attention from the real issues that are happening. But this has been overused. It's not the first time, you know, even before this report, we've had similar attacks by the Israeli authorities or those groups who are allied or working on the, say, kind of the same direction against Amnesty, against Human Rights Watch, against Palestinian and Israeli organizations. The attacks on human rights defenders is continuing. Last year, we've seen the criminalization of six prominent Palestinian civil society organizations, including three of the leading human rights organizations, Al-Haq, Defense for Children International, and Al-Damir, partner organizations of ours, right, who designated terrorists as a way of, of course, stopping the important work that they were doing, but also creating this chilling effect on others who are supporting them, either as partners or as donors or other, to basically continue to support the crucial work they're doing in documenting and reporting on human rights violations. So the response to these attacks is basically to continue doing the work to continue to document, to report, and try to defy the obstacles that are put. There's been threats by the Israeli authorities against us. So yes, you have the smears and these false attacks of anti-Semitism and other, but also there were threats to, for example, by the Minister of Interior, Ayelet Shaked, who said she wants to prevent Amnesty members from entering Israel. Threats from the Finance Minister, Avigdor Lieberman, who said he's going to use the, what is called the anti-boycott law against Amnesty International and its staff. And its tax exemption that it has as a civil society organization. We haven't seen any of those materialize yet, though we've seen threats materialize before. In 2019, we published a report on the link between online booking companies, tourism companies, Airbnb, Booking.com, Expedia, with settlements and how much there is a mutual benefit between the two. Following the publication of that report, there was threats by then Minister of Strategic Affairs, Gilad Erdan, to prevent Amnesty from working in Israel. A few months later, our colleague was placed under an arbitrary travel ban based on secret information. He remained under that travel ban for 2 years. And we weren't, of course, able to challenge it in court because it's secret information. And there's no due process when it comes to Palestinians, including human rights defenders. Eventually the ban was lifted and he was able to leave. But yes, you have threats, and sometimes these threats are implemented. It's a very difficult situation. And these attacks have to be seen in this larger context of Israel's anti-human rights agenda. Mm-hmm. And it is very similar to other repressive, oppressive states around the world.
Related to sort of these attacks, there's one thing that's really important about the report, and that also distinguishes itself from some other reports by other groups, was the inclusion of refugees in the analysis, noting that these laws which prevent Palestinian refugees from returning to their homes, or even laws that allow the expropriation of their property and their land, that is part of Israel's apartheid system. And again, you must have known that would be quite controversial, given that supporters of Israel will all often say that if you allow Palestinians the right to return to their homes, that would amount to the destruction of Israel as a Jewish state. So I guess, why was it important for you to include the aspect of refugees, and how did you navigate the inevitable sort of criticism on that?
The analysis and the understanding cannot be complete without understanding how Palestinian refugees, the denial of the right to return, is really crucial to the system of oppression and domination that we have, right? We were describing the system as fragmentation, segregation, dispossession, and deprivation. And the initial act of fragmentation was during the ethnic cleansing that took place in Palestine around the creation of the state from 1947 till 49, what Palestinians call a Nakba, and the pushing out of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians and not allowing them the right to return. Similar thing happened in 1967, where Palestinians were also forcibly displaced after the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, and they have also have not been allowed the right to return. This links directly to the intention to maintain demographic hegemony, is to ensure that Jewish Israelis are the majority of the population. It also relates directly to the geographic hegemony, the intent to maintain geographic hegemony, which is the maximum control over land. One of the discriminatory laws that are there, which we tackle in the report, is the law of return, which basically says that any Jew around the world has the right to come to Israel and be granted citizenship automatically upon return. While Palestinian refugees, they're not mentioned in this law, so their right to return is basically denied by negating in any way. It's not addressed. Palestinian refugees who have historic roots there, their homes, some of them still standing until today, some of them actually were internally displaced, like, for example, the village of Iqrith and Birahim in the Galilee. In the 1950s, they were forcibly displaced. They didn't leave the territory that became Israel. They are, until today, internally displaced people. They're not allowed to return to their villages, despite being, you know, living away from it for, like, basically a few kilometers. They still go there. The church, for example, in Iqrith is still standing, and so people go there for weddings and religious ceremonies and other, but the Israeli authorities prevent them from return. All their lands have been confiscated through various laws that make up Israel's land regime, regime put in place basically to dispossess Palestinians from their property and land. And actually, there is a very interesting story now of the community making wine of their vines that were confiscated are now controlled by a nearby Jewish community. So despite them being their vines, they are buying the grapes from now the new administrators of the land and making this wine again, which is very traditional to that village. And so without really centering this into the analysis of the system, you won't understand what demographic hegemony and geographic hegemony means. You won't understand what the system means. And how apartheid here in this context really works, right? Mm-hmm. So it is not about only about these patterns of violations. It's about this system, and at the heart of it is this fragmentation, starting from in Nakba and continuing until this day. This is why refugees are so important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I definitely thought that part of the report was particularly an important contribution, and I definitely encourage people to read it. It really lays out how those policies, how refugees really are at the core of everything in some ways. So that's excellent. I guess we should probably wrap it up. We're running out of time. Do you have any thoughts on how Canadians can support this growing anti-apartheid movement that Amnesty is contributing to? How can we support your recommendations?
Sustainable long-term. I mean, one thing is to, understand kind of the theory of change, which I think, is that we really need to make it more politically and economically costly for Israel to continue on doing what it's doing, the crime against humanity of apartheid. At the same time, we need to be supporting in solidarity and other means the resistance to this system of oppression and domination by both Palestinians and Israelis. And this is very important to also kind of highlight. Yes, Palestinians are at the forefront of acting against the system, but also there are Israelis who are acting in solidarity with them, and they're standing shoulder by shoulder in many places, highlighting apartheid. Like I want to mention, on the 17th of April, there was a protest held by Israeli anti-apartheid activists in front of the Shabak, which is the Israel Internal Security Agency offices in Tel Aviv, to highlight the issue of administrative detention. And one of the activists, they were both Jewish Israelis, and there was a Palestinian Israeli activist. Only a Palestinian citizen of Israel was arrested in this protest, and everybody else was released. And very interesting op-ed by Netta Golan, who was there in the protest that I recommend people to see in Haaretz, talking about the experience. So this is the theory of change. And, you know, linking back to what I was saying before is that we're not relying on governments to create the change we want to see. We want to create power among people in organizing together, in seeing the affinity between different struggles, and really pushing within your local community at the municipal level, with your parliamentarians, with your family and with other, and really building this power up. And I think, you know, you're on the right course, and we'll continue to do this together.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us today to talk about this. Tom, have any last thoughts?
Well, you know, before we started recording, of course, I thanked you for your work, and I just, maybe we should have it on the podcast itself. CJPME thanks Amnesty very much for their work on this. It's a huge tool for us in our work with members of parliament and governments here in Canada. So please, you know, pass our thanks to your colleague. And one other thing I'll mention too is that sometimes we write reports once in a while too, and sometimes you're at 30 pages, 40 pages, 60 pages, and you wonder, is anyone going to read this? Well, Michael actually took the report one weekend and he read it from cover to cover. I've skimmed it from cover to cover, but Michael has read it from cover to cover. So there are actually people that look at this stuff and look through it very carefully. So thank you for your great work on this.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Michael. Really appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today.
If you're a listener and you've enjoyed our podcast today, please subscribe to our channel. We're on all the major audio podcast platforms. If you can, please leave a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people to find your program and learn about the issues. This podcast is a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, CJPME, and seeks to advance its mission to empower Canadians of all backgrounds to promote justice, development, and peace in the Middle East. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions about our podcast or our topics, please feel free to email us at info@cjpme.org. Thanks to all our supporters who helped make this podcast and all CJPME's other activities possible. Thanks also to Madeline Moffitt, our podcast engineer and consultant. So that's it for now. We'll look forward to having you all with us for our next podcast. Take care and see you all again soon.
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
There's a lot going on in the world today. See how it affects Montreal's Black and Caribbean community. Read the Community Contact. News, features, opinions, music reviews, cultural events, and so much more. Our voices, our perspectives, our community. published every 2 weeks, pick it up at your favorite community spot or visit us online at our new and dynamic website, mtlcommunitycontact.com. Easy to navigate and lots to enjoy. Archived.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Teleoff.com.